All right, welcome to Wait, What If? Number 15. It's a round number, so I feel like we should have some sort of celebration, right? As humans,
nobody has anything at 15.
Yeah, they do. Isn't there 15? I guess it's more at 10.
I think it's more of a 10.
25. That's a 5.
25,
yeah,
might be a good one.
Yeah, 30. You'll never make it to 25.
Why do we like that? Why are humans? Enough out of you. Why do we like random round numbers like that? Can you explain? Anyone? Any guess? All right. Already derailed. Let's go with the guest list. Today we have guest John Taylor. He's a true crime author. He has written, John, you think I would have this right here in front of me, but I had my other thing. Why don't you tell us the two books that you wrote? One was on JonBenet and the other one was on Nancy Cooper. I know that,
that's
right?
That's correct. Okay. Yes, I've written two books. I read the Umbrella of Suspicion on the JonBenet Ramsey case in 2012.
Okay.
And in 2014, I wrote Isolated Incident, which addresses the Nancy Cooper case from Cary, North Carolina.
Okay. And people can get those on Amazon?
Amazon.com,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. And then how about your website? They can check it out there, too.
My website, truecrimewriting.com, is a place that I use to kind of either post articles that I've written, short stories in the true crime genre, or just keep updates on either what I'm doing or what I'm interested in.
Okay. How hard was it to get that website? Because that's kind of true crime writing. You think that would have been snatched up already.
It was very easy. I was expecting to have to get something quirky, but yeah. I was really lucky.
Yeah.
A number of people have told me that they think that URL is worth quite a bit, so I'm pretty happy to have it.
Yeah, just have it in your back pocket. There you go.
Exactly.
But we are outside, so I have to give the caveat that you're going to hear the background noise again, the cicadas. But it in North Carolina is actually cooling off a little bit. It's only in the 80s.
It's now. Lovely.
Yeah. Mike, how's it going?
Pretty good.
Mike is full of words tonight. He's sitting back there just smiling. I don't know what's going on.
Malia brought candied bacon.
Bourbon.
Candied bacon, and I've eaten half of it.
That is.
I want to be preoccupied for a while with this.
It's really tasty. It's not like that peel and throw it, you know, the package bacon. That's like the thick
cut. Mm-hmm.
You just chop the side of a pig off type of bacon.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening in my life right now, Kevin.
It's good stuff. I can write you a script for statin if you want. Cholesterol lowering medication.
I'm not worried about it.
Okay, that's good.
I'm just going to eat this bacon and drink this whiskey. And
all right, you're going to partake in the conversation.
Absolutely.
All that. All right, very
Absolutely.
Good. Okay. All right, so we got a bunch of questions, obviously, to go over with John here. He's got a pretty interesting story and much more interesting take on things like true crime and everything than us three would have. We just kind of. Yap about the Fermi paradox and Schrodinger's cat and all that good stuff.
I've read a few things in college.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, go ahead. Sorry,
no.
I won't speak for you.
You can if you'd like. I don't mind. No, I majored in criminal justice with a minor in philosophy. I thought I was going to law school, and then that didn't work out. I didn't do it. I went to the Marine Corps instead. I'm curious if you're interviewing practices or anything like. Truman Capote's in Cold Blood. If you go visit the guys, or kind of like he did, he doesn't take notes or record anything. It was all
up to this point, I've interviewed a couple like the victims' families. I have corresponded with a few people that were either convicted or accused of murder, but so far I haven't gone that route. I definitely am interested in doing that. There's some concerns I have as far as. Especially if the case is still going on, if something I did could impact the judicial system, I don't want to do that. And then there's also the concern that somebody who's in prison can be trying to manipulate me. A lot of the people, and when you wanted to talk about, you know, maybe psychopaths, which would be what I would be most interested in talking to. And the problem there is because they're always trying to work you. So how much information I can get from doing, how valuable is it? But from a purely interest standpoint, not necessarily knowledge gaining, I very much want to do that going forward.
Hmm. How are the families when you go talk to them? So did you talk to the Cooper family?
I did not. Okay. I talked to on another local case that I was working on. And it's very tough because you're trying to get information, but the rapport is so much more important because you're looking at somebody who's suffering or – who is confused at the same time. They don't know what happened to their, you know, child or sibling. And so for me, it's just, it's very, very difficult for me to do because I'm in information mode, and it kind of derails me from that, because then I just totally turn into, you know, the sympathy and empathy of the situation. And I'm much more consumed with their emotions than I am right. in trying to find out things. And then I realize I didn't ask the questions I needed to ask.
Do you go in and let them know that this is, so let's say I'm a victim's family and you're coming in. My first thought would be, a writer is also maybe a type of press, and you're trying to
sensationalize
maybe? Or anything like that off of my tragedy. How do you approach that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, for me, my ultimate, like, why I pursue a case is usually twofold. One is I like cases that are somewhat unsolved or it's ambiguous. I find it as like the ultimate puzzle. So I just get that is very interesting to me, trying to figure out what happened. And the other thing is usually there's some element of the case that either has been overlooked or I feel like the narrative in the case is wrong.
Okay.
That the people who have, you know, done reporting on it haven't hit on what I think is important.
Okay.
So those are kind of the things that I'm looking for. With going in and talking to the a victim's family, I mean, one of the things I'm trying to do is I'm trying to solve that case. That's what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, will I be able to? I don't know. So for me, it's managing that expectation, but that let them know that's really what I'm trying to do. I'm going to write about it, but that I want to figure out what happened.
Okay.
But for me, it's very important for them to know that, you know, I may not, but that I'm going to have an opinion. I'm going to look at it. I'm not encumbered by some of the things that law enforcement and other people are. I don't really have an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, if I could solve a case or help a family and sell zero books, I would take that any day over selling a lot of books. Like, that's not my goal. I don't
Sure.
make a living off selling. So it's a hobby to me that I happen to make a little bit of money at through selling books on Amazon.
Okay.
But for me, it's a passion. It's not something I'm looking to make money at.
Is it almost a type of investigative journalism?
I don't like to use the word journalism just mm-hmm. because, I mean, I've got a pretty negative take on the media overall.
Sure.
So to me, I may go into it unbiased, but usually I form an opinion at some point and I don't hide that.
Okay.
So I'm not pretending that I'm looking, you know, that I feel I'm completely neutral. I let it be known. I feel that's important. That you put that out there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like that when that's one of the things I don't like about journalism is that they're pretending to be neutral
right.
when in fact they have very clear opinions about what they're reporting and they're just not saying.
Right.
Do you go into it letting the people you're interviewing, do you say, I have an opinion and here's where I think maybe it's been overlooked and I would like your opinion on that? Or do you just ask for their take on it and then you develop your opinion based on that?
I try not to provide too much information, more of it, the information coming towards me.
Right.
And anytime I'm working on a case, the majority of the first phase is just spent researching and digging into everything I can find out there. And I'll look at, I mean, most of the people in any case, especially if it's been either adjudicated or it's well known, those people have been interviewed multiple times. So mm-hmm. I do a lot. I spend a lot of time looking at the interviews. One of the big things, linguistics is something that I really focus in on is the words that people use and the way that they convey information.
You mean those who are interviewed prior?
Yeah, anyone. Okay. That's another, if I have an opportunity to do interviews myself, I will. But for me, it's more advantageous to be able to see the questions and answers in writing and study them.
Right.
Whereas if I'm interviewing somebody, I mean, I got to think about what I'm going to say.
Mm-hmm.
I have to think about what they're saying. I have to pay attention and look them in the eye and I have to take notes or whatever. There's so many things going on.
Right.
Just as, I mean, a detective in an interrogation has to deal with all those things, which is usually why they have two. So one of them's paying attention more to the interviewee. But for me, to be able to look at it in writing, I can really dig into it and I can read it multiple times. And I just find that very helpful. When I look at cases, I mean, there's each case, there's different things that are really critical to that case. But in general, the words that either the suspect or the witnesses that they're using is arguably the most important, at least for me, what mm-hmm. I think, in determining what happened.
Right.
So, well, we're interviewing here. Mike is actually over there, and he's studying you. So I'm asking the questions, and he's coming up with
It's like
he's taking notes.
We set up like this on purpose. I don't know if you're familiar
good
with
cop,
Jurassic,
bad cop.
Jurassic Park. When Velociraptor. That's not the one that's dangerous.
It's, it's on the side.
Yeah.
Clever girl.
And I just thought he was just gazing off into the sunset over there. I didn't realize he was stalking me.
He does that.
He's in a
special
port
guy.
Coma.
That's right.
I was curious. Well, actually, I'm curious on a few things. One, what's your background in?
My background. So my background is in two different areas. So my undergrad and graduate degrees are in finance, and I've worked in corporate finance and finance for small companies for off and on for quite a while now. When I got out of college, out of undergrad, I went to work for the Secret Service, and I worked for them for about 4.5 years. Doing presidential protection, dignitaries, some financial crime investigation, which is what I really went in to do with the finance degree. But I found out pretty quickly that the focus in the Secret Service is on protection. I mean, that's where that's the ultimate kind of driver of the organization. So I did some intelligence investigations for them and a lot of advance work and things of that nature. And from there, I was, like I said, I was there for about 4.5 years. Then I went to grad school, got my MBA in finance, and just went into working in consulting and working in finance because that's another area I wanted to delve into. And then once I got into finance, one of the things that occurred to me, I was working on a number of acquisitions and mergers, was that we're looking at these audited financial statements, and you've got some assurance as to what these companies are doing, but you don't know the real story. And I started realizing a lot of these companies were not being honest with us.
Right.
And so I started thinking about how I could uncover what's really going on in companies that, you know, that we're trying to acquire. And I took that information, and basically I ended up starting a company that was basically focused on detection deception within financial statements. So it was kind of combining my background in criminal investigations with my financial background.
Right.
And I did that for a while, and I liked that. So I developed like this research model that was designed to basically pick up on when management, like either in their earnings calls or in their SEC disclosures, as far as information that could indicate either that they're being deceptive, misleading, there's things they're not telling us, those kinds of things. And basically that work got me back into thinking about true crime.
Right.
So it's kind of like I kind of came around full circle.
And you, I think I read in your bio, you since a kid, you were kind of infatuated with this sort of stuff, right?
Yeah, I mean, and actually both of them at a very young age. I don't know why I was obsessed with finance at the age of 11 or 12 as well, but I was. But also true crime. And for me, and I've thought about it, I don't really know where it comes from other than when I was a kid, my mom read a lot of true crime. So there were a lot of books in the house. And thinking back, you know, she read fiction and she read true crime. Well, fiction doesn't usually have pictures.
Right.
When you're a kid, the pictures are appealing. Mm-hmm. So looking at the true crime books, there was a lot of pictures.
Yeah.
And so that just kind of piqued my interest at looking at these famous cases, and it just kind of got me interested and got me reading in that genre.
And you were interested in like hitmen and stuff like that. So did you read about all the like the New York crime families and
there's
a lot of pictures associated with
it. Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah, the mafia was very interesting to me, still is, because it's kind of a combination. It's crime and business.
That's right. Yeah.
We could talk about The Sopranos all night, but that that's my favorite show as far as just you know understand a psychopath this running a business organization is basically what that show is about.
Yeah.
But so yeah, the mafia and organized crime, that's always been very interesting to me. Serial killers, anything that is completely out of the ordinary and something that I wouldn't have encountered growing up in a small Midwestern town.
That's right, yeah.
This may be the most interesting man I've ever met and accomplished. You've done a lot.
You're questioning my story.
I'm questioning that you're a legal adult.
Okay. Fair enough.
You look like you're 20, and yet you've done more than a lot of people do in their entire career.
I don't like to admit it, but I am 41 years old.
You are a liar. Yeah. The entire thing is a lie.
I would say that my secret, I sleep a lot. I'd say that's my, and I'm sure you appreciate that having two toddlers, me talking about how much I sleep.
But. Well,
why do you think I go to work?
Yeah.
I tell my secretary, I'm like, no patients from 10 to 1.
Yeah.
I'm busy.
I had an office mate who had 4 kids, and he used to come into the office and he would just like unwind. And I was like, you know, I'm so stressed out being at work. He's like, oh, this the best part of my day. You know, I don't have any. All I have to do is do a job. I don't have, you know, my kids, everybody here hounding
so
me.
True.
So your first job out of college was Secret Service?
Yes.
What made you decide to go that route?
I had a couple aspects. I mean, one was, I guess, you know, very early on, I also had a fascination with JFK assassination. Mm-hmm. So that whole, I did a lot of studying of the Secret Service around that and protecting someone. So that was interesting to me. And then with the getting the finance degree and kind of thinking I didn't want to work on Wall Street coming out of college, just kind of talking to the people.
This probably would have been the late 90s too, right?
Mid-90s, yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it was a great time. I mean, finance was booming at that time with mm-hmm. the stock market. But so I thought, you know, maybe I want to do something different. So I looked into the criminal investigations, and I thought with the finance degree, they investigate counterfeit, financial fraud, bank fraud, that I thought it would be a good combination. So it's kind of that. And I thought it'd be a bonus of being around doing presidential protection. Yeah. I thought that would be pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. Mike was, you already said you were Marine. I was Air Force. We're all G-men, I guess. Yeah. I didn't wear a suit. Well, no, Air Force, that is their uniform. We call it a leisure suit. Polyester leisure suit.
Hey, how's your relationship working with law enforcement when you're trying to pull different, I guess, the transcripts or something or whatever from an interview that detectives have done?
Yeah, I mean,
how does that work? Because if it's...
I mean, primarily I try to focus on cases that are older just because I don't want to encounter that. But ultimately, I'm going to have to take a case that's pretty hot or that's going on right now. So that's always been a concern. And being former law enforcement, I've always just been very concerned. I don't want to disrupt anything. I don't want to do anything that could affect anything they're doing. However, like with the Nancy Cooper case, I mean, I'm very uncomfortable. Not that I've ever had any interactions with the police in Cary, but I'd be very uncomfortable being in Cary just because of that case and what I've written about it. I mean, I'm not complimentary about the Cary Police Department.
I grew up in Cary, so. <Yeah. laughs>
When you say when you have, unless I heard you wrong, you said when you have to write a case. You also said you do this as a hobby. So when you said when you have to write on something.
But no,
if you have to go through Cary.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't ever have to write something.
How
do I choose
topics?
My cases, my topics? It's really just interest. I do a lot of just kind of right now. I mean, I do a lot of surfing of what's going on, cases that are going on, looking for things that are out of the ordinary, cases that, like I said, that don't look like the way they're being reported, the information that's being presented to me is not telling the whole story. So it allows me to dig in there and try to figure out, you know, my opinion as to what I think happened. Mm-hmm. So that's really what I'm looking for. Something that's not solved or something that has a very interesting angle. It's got a very interesting person in it, or there's something that drives me, right, you know, as far as the interest. Like with the JonBenet Ramsey case, the first thing that drew me to that case was the father, John Ramsey. He's a very successful businessman, very sharp guy, but he's also somebody who was a very arrogant person, and that came across very poorly whenever he went on television. And if you listen to people talk about, you know, why they think that, you know, he may have been involved in what happened to her, a lot of it is how he came across in the media. He did not come across well.
Right. Flat effect type of deal?
Right, and he's not showing the emotion people are expecting. And so that was interesting to me because just right off the bat, I mean, I didn't like the way the parents were acting either, but I felt like there could be reasons for that.
Right.
And just trying to understand why he is the way he is and why he is reacting the way he's reacting.
Did you go out to Colorado to do that? Or
I did go out. I went out to Boulder just to kind of look at the area and check on just the different things that are mentioned in any of the case files or the different books. I've read probably 10 books on that case.
When you say that, there's something that stands out to just my research for this interview was that just looking at psychopaths and sociopaths, there's actually a high number of, they say, CEOs and people who are in power, politicians that are, in fact, have psychopathy, that are in that realm. Mike, I told Mike the other day that it's 1% of the population. He didn't believe me, but it is. I looked it up and I found out what 1% of the population is said to have psychopathic.
I was just curious how the heck they come up with that number.
Well, I can give you the source right here, Mike.
And who would think that three
Robert
of
D.
Us
Hare,
would all be sitting here right now?
But yeah, I mean, and that sort of makes sense. What do you think that the murder happened within the family, or are you at liberty to say things like that, or how did you?
With that case, I certainly think that something happened within the home,
mm-hmm.
and the single biggest contributing factor to kind of making that conclusion would be the ransom note,
right.
which I've read. I don't know if I've read it 100 times, but I may have.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a lot of telling aspects of that that really convey that it wasn't somebody that was, you know, foreign to the family.
I took a criminal justice class or something. I was a sociology minor, and I wish I could remember the guy's name. You'd probably know it. He's an FBI profiler, mm-hmm. and I think he was one of the first. He might even have
John Douglas is who you're thinking.
Yeah, he coined the term serial killer, and he would go in and interview all these guys, like sit across the table in prisons,
right?
And he had mentioned that he gave just a guest lecture, and it was about how the ransom note itself. He read it, and he said, you know, it was I don't even know how many years ago now, 20 years ago, but he said that was written by the mother or father, mm-hmm. or here that was written by someone who loved this child, and. I don't remember exactly why he said that, but I don't know. Do you know anything about that? what?
here's some stuff. Can you tell me about it?
Yeah, I mean, isn't that he's the pro?
Yeah. Well, you touched on a number of topics there. I mean, you've mentioned psychopath. You're talking about serial killers and profiling,
right?
And profiling. To start there, I guess that is the very first thing that got me involved in trying to research that case was John Douglas's approach to this case.
Okay.
I felt like he just made a lot of mistakes in his assessment, and basically, yeah, I mean, like for example, one of them that I recall was that he was saying, you know, that somebody who killed their child would not be the one who found him. The child. They would let someone else find him, and John Ramsey found his daughter. So that was like his excluding John Ramsey from it, which obviously doesn't exclude the wife because she didn't find him.
Right.
And he seemed to miss that. And the other thing just with profiling is that it's you're looking at averages and, mm-hmm. you know, serial killers tend to do this or they're like this. And that's not every serial killer. It's just the majority of them or whatever their statistics are spewing out. So I find that the profiling, though interesting, is very dangerous as far as you know law enforcement using it to make decisions and, you know, lead investigations based on averages.
Right.
Would this be why you tweeted, criminal profiling provides a lot of generalized useless information?
Yes.
Look at that. I did my research. So do you feel the same way with, like, up in New York when they had this stop and frisk going on for a while, which is a type of criminal profiling. However, when they were doing that, they saw a big reduction in violent crime.
Where what are you talking, when you're saying they're stopping and frisking, was that like in New York City or was
it was
into
New York
a building
City.
Or
it was under Giuliani and then whoever, they never overturned it. So it became a NYPD practice. I think that you could stop and frisk, which constitutionally is completely against the
Fourth Amendment.
So, but they were doing it. They were stopping it first. I want to say it was youths, 18 to or 16 to 22 men, black men probably, in the city. It was. I mean, I think that's what it was. And that's why they said, that's why they, obviously, the new guy came in and overturned it. But when he overturned that, the gun violence and everything is starting to rise again.
I would say that has a deterrent effect.
Right.
So that would be certainly much more effective than just profiling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that I would condone what they're doing.
Right.
But if you were looking for serial killers and you were stopping every car with a white male between the age of 30 and 40 and assuming they're a serial killer, yeah, that would be more effective than just saying that, you know, his mom was probably really controlling and he wet the bed as a kid.
Right.
Like, I don't know, you know how that helps.
Yeah.
And I was reading a quote with the case out in Wichita, the BTK killer. I'm reading a book on that, and one of the profiles said that we're pretty sure that this guy doesn't look like a serial killer, that he blends into society.
But isn't that the thing with serial killers?
All of them, but I'm like, because, you know, one, he'd eluded the authorities for like 30 years.
Right.
I'm like, well, that's a pretty astute observation that they had. And two, I'm like, you've just basically eliminated, you know, like a tenth of a percent of the population.
Right.
And like, what are you supposed to do with that information? If the person looks like a serial killer, then we know it's not him.
Right.
But everyone else is a suspect.
Right.
And I'm just like, you know, like this is the what, you know, like the Wichita were bringing the experts and this is what they were telling him. And I'm just like, I just don't find a lot of value in that.
Well, can I ask, is it just definitively, are all serial killers, do they all fit the classification of being psychopaths? Do you have to be a psychopath to be a serial killer? And if so, are there really any generalizations you can make about a psychopath? Aren't they just so wired completely differently?
So the terms that you're using are definable, but there's not like a hard definition for them. So for a psychopath, which is sometimes used interchangeably with a sociopath, they're not always. And now there's a new clinical antisocial personality disorder. Yeah.
That's actually, sorry, but that's the old adage. Well, it's still used today, but now there's the DMSV, which is a diagnostic management of psychiatric disorders. That's coming out. I think it already came out, actually, the five. I think it came out last year. But the fifth iteration is adding psychopathy and sociopaths
to that definition. Category.
Yeah, I don't even know if they call it a personality disorder. I don't work in mental health, so I haven't read it, but I don't know if they're in the same category as antisocial personality disorder, which is a branch of ODD. It's Cara would know what this is. My wife's a teacher, and there's a thing
she
for
deals
kids.
With a lot of psychopaths. Yeah. Is that what you're
future psychopaths. There's a thing ODD, and it means it's basically the precursor to your antisocial. But they're very real, and you know, you go to a prison, and if they run the criteria, it's something like 90%, 89% of the prison population has antisocial personality disorder. And of that, it's like 30 to 50% are psychopaths or fall within that range of psychopaths.
I have heard those statistics. For a psychopath in general, I mean, there's like, 20 criteria, and it's fairly subjective. But for me, the primary factor is a lack of empathy. There are a number of factors that play into it, but that is really the one that is the most problematic. I mean, you have a shallow affect and you don't get along with others and you're narcissistic or whatever. But the lack of empathy is what enables you to harm other people and to do it repeatedly without having the guilt that hopefully all four of us would feel.
We were talking about that the other night. We were talking about this. So I don't remember why I was over there, but probably just drink whiskey. But we were chatting about this interview, and we were like, just coming up with ideas and things to talk about. And we were saying that in certain crimes, you can almost empathize with the criminal. Mm-hmm. So the poor guy who's hard on his luck, who has kids to feed, goes into a store with a gun and robs him and takes money.
Right.
Although the majority of people who are raised properly, who have any sort of morals and conscience, would not do that. But you can empathize where he stands when he does that.
Right.
And it's when that person crosses the line and commits the murder, shoots the store clerk, that's where I think there's the disconnect. I mean, everyone can see themselves in a situation. At least you can kind of identify with someone who's in a desperate situation. But to cross the line and to take someone's life as if they are a roadblock to your ultimate goal is where I think the disease state lies. With that said, we also talked about that there's also situations where, like when we're out and about, I conceal carry for the sole purpose of protecting my family. And if something ever happened to my family, I wouldn't think twice. Mm-hmm. But I guess you're looking at it too, that if someone were to shoot at us or try to harm my family, I wouldn't think twice about killing them.
Yeah, and I think those kinds of crimes, if you call it, self-defense isn't a crime, but you mentioned the store owner, those are much easier to understand, and most people are comfortable with those types of crimes, comfortable in that they can understand it. Mm-hmm. They may not do it, but they understand, the person needed something or they're down on their luck and those kinds of crimes. But when you get more, and the term psychopath, people assume that means that the person's violent. They don't necessarily have to be violent.
Right.
So, you're talking about, a CEO or somebody high up in an organization. They may have those characteristics, but they're not violent, mm-hmm. or most of them are not, or we don't know that they are.
Right.
So they're falling into that category, but they're not a concern to you physically. They may, not have a problem with laying you off. Like, that may not bother them as much as somebody else. But the psychopath that has the lack of empathy that's also violent is really, when people think of a psychopath or sociopath, that's what they're thinking of. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned serial killers, and that's another term that is, you know, loosely defined. But normally, a serial killer, I would say, is a psychopath, because a serial killer is usually killing for reasons other than reasons. They're doing it for their own benefit, basically, which is what makes it so hard to understand, that you are getting some kind of gratification out of killing a stranger
and possibly torturing them. Lack of empathy, because a murderer may kill somebody but then feel bad enough about it that they're like, okay, that was a big mistake. Even if I had my reasons, that was a big mistake.
Right.
And I feel guilt and I won't do it again. What then leads to serial killers is that there's reason or not, there's total lack of guilt or empathy and, in fact, intrigue. So they'll go and do it again.
Yeah, it's a stimulus to them.
Right.
And I don't fully understand it. I mean, the more I think about it, the harder it is to comprehend. But, you know, I read this stuff. Another thing with the profiling is, oh, you know, they won't stop until they're caught. Yet some of these killers go years without killing people. Like, I don't know. I mean, if they really have that strong of a compulsion, how are they not doing it for years?
Right.
Like, I don't know. But that happens.
That sparks me to wonder, you know, there are inner city gang members, and then there are mafia-related people who have killed people, multiple people, and they continue to do it. And we wouldn't look at them and go, oh, well, they're serial killers.
Right.
Yeah, because you could have someone that kills only one person and have them be classified as a serial killer, right?
I think the criteria is three or more.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
And don't they say that there's so many active serial killers out there at any given moment, and they're not either sensationalized or people haven't picked up on the fact that, hey, this murder matches that murder. There's
right.
some connection.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know. A lot of those statistics, I don't know. I don't put a lot of stock in them.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that they give you a general idea. But, you know, is the prison population 20% psychopathic, 30%, 10%? I don't know. But they'll assign a number because they did, you know, they pooled, you know, did a poll of 50 people, and that's what they came up with.
Right.
But yeah, I think there certainly are cases out there that are related that law enforcement hasn't tied together that could have been done by the same individual that, you know, could be a serial killer.
I think there's a bit of an obsession within the public about that because there is that terrifying factor. There's that I had mentioned in our questions I sent to you that, you know, you can have supernatural and there's only so much that you can scare someone with that. But when you talk about monsters that are basically among us, it becomes something very real, something that could happen to you, heck, walking to get your mail. And I think that's where society likes those stats in a way, because it's in a grim way, it's almost thrilling to know that there are actual monsters out there.
Yeah, it is an interesting. You'd mentioned the idea of driving to the beach, and people are more scared of getting attacked by a shark, though they're more likely to be killed in the car on the way there. And
Absolutely.
that's a great example. It's very true. And I'd say, you know, with what you're talking about, I mean, you're much more likely to be killed by your spouse than you are by a stranger or serial killer.
Right.
Yet most people aren't terrified of their spouse and sleeping with one eye open.
I'm terrified of my spouse, actually.
I don't know. We should get my husband over here.
Aren't you?
Ask him that.
Why are you staring?
Statistically, you're actually more likely to kill yourself. Isn't there more suicides in this country than
there
is
murders? That's true. Yeah, you got to keep an eye on yourself.
So there
at the
you
same
go.
Time.
Watch yourself.
18 to 40 years old.
How am I supposed to look at myself?
18 to 40 years old. It's like the number. It's like the fifth most leading cause of death.
It's incredible.
Yeah.
I don't have nothing else. I just
yeah.
We just need to keep our eye on you, is what you're saying over there. I think.
Suicide watch, Mike.
Yeah. This may completely derail or, you know, backtrack. You can feel free to edit out everything I ever say.
I always do. 90% of what
I've never heard you on any
podcast. Yeah, neither have I, and I've listened to all of them.
I don't turn her mic on.
No. But to go back, based on kind of now what we're gathering, in your research, and especially once it becomes published, how do the families or have you ever gotten any direct response from people who have been affected by it? Do they read, you know, the work that you've done and feel like you're an advocate for them? Are they appreciative of it? Have you gotten any negative responses?
Yeah, I've gotten both, and I take it too personally, I guess is what I would say. But you get both sides, and normally it's not the family, usually they usually have people that are kind of like standing up for them because they're not usually emotionally able to do a lot.
Right.
But so I've gotten both negative and positive on things that I've done. Mm-hmm. They complain about, you know, something that I said or that I was wrong on something, or they're, you know, appreciative that I'm, you know, bringing light to the case or something like that. So it goes both ways. But I try not to, you know, like I said, I have an opinion, but I try to be objective. Mm-hmm. I don't have an agenda necessarily other than hopefully figuring out what happened.
How about like law enforcement and legal counsel? Do you get from them that, well, if you're feeling that maybe the crime wasn't handled properly or the correct people might not have been focused on, do you ever get any resistance where they're like, no, no, you can't say that or you can't publish that or that's...
No, I haven't. I haven't been told that I couldn't publish something.
Okay.
But I mean, if I'm factually wrong, that's my biggest kind of problem is if I'm factually wrong on something, then I could, that kind of legally I can get into issues. But if it's just my opinion,
right,
then I'm pretty covered,
right,
as far as that goes.
And if anything's already been published or documented, if you're going on those basis,
right,
then, you know, you're not slandering anybody on anything that wasn't already there for the public to find.
Right. I mean, obviously, I try to use multiple sources if I can. But, right, yeah, there are sources that are wrong. People get things wrong. I had a case where I was quoting somebody that was testifying in court, and they're testifying under oath. And the guy had absolutely no reason. He wasn't lying. He's just wrong. And he was wrong on the time that he saw something. And I went on that. Now, there was other documentation that was contrary to what he said. But I just, when I was writing up the analysis, I went on his testimony, and it turns out that was wrong,
right,
and he was wrong.
Right.
But, you know, because I went back and checked it after someone's like, oh, that's the wrong time. But, you know, so it's tough to keep all that straight. And one of the things in these criminal cases that's so interesting is people think that if people don't have a reason to lie, they won't lie. Or they feel that things that happen before a crime are honest. So if someone was murdered, what's in their journal, well, that's the truth.
Right.
Right. The victim, whatever they wrote in that journal is the truth. They'd have no reason to lie.
Right.
And that's like a kind of an implicit thing in a lot of these cases that you see that's mind-boggling, because obviously just because someone wrote in a journal doesn't mean that it's true or they told their best friend.
Have you seen Gone Girl?
I have. I've read the book.
Wasn't that great? I didn't know it was a book. It was,
yeah.
What?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't have time. I love movie. Turn brain off for 2 hours. Click.
Again, if it's on Netflix, it must be true.
Yeah.
So when you find something like that that contradicts what somebody said, what do you do with that information? Do you present it to the law enforcement or to a lawyer? I mean, where do you go with that? I mean, at some point you're going to publish this work. And then what do you?
Yeah, if it were material, if I thought it was something really significant, I definitely would do something with it. But that stuff happens all the time.
Okay. And you could only do that in an unsolved case, right? You couldn't if it's already been.
No, I mean if it was in a case and someone got convicted and it was a material item, I could take it to the defense and say this is something you should look at, you know, trying to go out on appeal on.
Right.
But I mean, it'd have to be pretty significant.
Did right. Cooper? Did his? Or his conviction get overturned or something weird happened with him, right?
Yes. So he was convicted and then the Court of Appeals overturned the conviction.
So is he free?
No. He ended up pleading guilty.
Really?
To the case, yes.
Huh.
Wow. Wait, so after he was after it was overturned, or was prior to the overturn?
No. They over... So
I don't, where, who said
so he gets convicted. He right. goes to prison.
Right.
Then his lawyers file appeals. They went to the appeal court. They won in the Court of Appeals. The Supreme Court of North Carolina declined to review it. So that means basically that he no longer is convicted. So he's just in prison waiting a new trial.
Okay.
Rather than going to trial a second time, he opted to take a plea. And so he pled guilty, I think, to second degree murder, but I'm not sure offhand.
Did that surprise you?
It did until I thought about it.
Okay.
And there were a number of factors that occurred that, I mean, I wrote a short piece on it as to, unfortunately, there are times when pleading guilty, even if you're innocent, is the right thing to do.
Right.
And I think that was the case here.
For the listeners, Nancy right. Cooper, it was back in what year? 2008. Wow.
Yes.
We actually lived right up the road from her. You know, the corner of Kildare Farm and, you know where Trader Joe's is?
Yeah.
Yeah. We lived right there.
Cary Parkway.
Thank right. you. When it happened, I mean, it freaked us out. We're like, this is right around here. So
right.
we volunteered and helped walk and look for her and all that. And
wow.
Yeah, it was one of those things that really hit close to home because, I mean, this is in our backyard. She was a housewife that had just disappeared. And you could probably explain a little bit better than me.
Right. So it was Brad and Nancy Cooper. They had two young girls. They lived there in Cary. Brad worked at Cisco and Nancy was a stay-at-home mom. And basically, she went out running. And at least this was the initial story, and never came back. And one of her friends called 911. The police came, and it was a missing persons case for a couple days. And then it turned into a murder case when they found her body. I think it was about 2 or 3 days later.
In a pond, right?
It was a drainage ditch
okay.
that was in like a neighborhood that was being developed. And it went from that to, you know, he was arrested for murder. And, you know, the prosecution speculated that, you know, he killed her inside the house was their theory.
And there was, I mean, I've read, and it was just through the newspapers at the time when the trial was going on and everything, but there were some interesting things in there. The girlfriend who had called the police had said, she's missing, look towards the husband.
Right.
So there had been some speculation that there was something going on within the house. And mm-hmm. and didn't did she tell her friend that if something ever happens to me, look towards Brad? Or
This is a case that is, it's such an interesting case of the dynamics of a marriage. And between a woman and a husband as far as what's going on and what people perceive from the outside versus what people inside the relationship are actually experiencing, what they believe. And so Nancy was very upset with Brad, and she was telling everyone and anyone who would listen how she felt about him. And the primary complaint that she had was that she was being put on a budget. And that she didn't have any money for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, being in Cary, which is a very affluent area, this just shocked and appalled everyone. So Brad is controlling.
World problems.
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they were, everyone's just so mad at Brad and appalled at him. And nobody asked, the very obvious question would be, why do you need to be on a budget? And the answer was because she was spending money like out of control. And so, but that question was never asked. So the friends all had this perception of Brad of being this controlling guy that was just horrible to Nancy and had an affair. And so that was already out there when she went missing. And Brad is the kind of guy that it does not appear that he can carry on a conversation comfortably with someone else. He's an introvert. He's a techie, somebody that's more cerebral. And so that did not bode well for him.
Right.
That was a huge blow to him in this case. And the other thing is, and I don't know this for certain, I have written him several times, but he hasn't written me back, is that Nancy was conveying things to him very differently than what she was conveying to her friends and family. So she was telling her friends and family, we're getting a divorce, this is over. And what she was telling Brad, I think, was slightly different than that. Mm-hmm. But the police took what his version as that he was lying.
Right.
That you know, clearly he's just lying to us and he's pretending like the marriage is great.
Right.
But there was a lot of mistakes that were made, in my opinion, in the investigation and in the court case. And it's just a very interesting case with, as far as, like, some of the dynamic of relationship, how important it is that the emotion in regard to a tragedy is a very interesting thing because people put a tremendous amount of weight on it, though I think it provides no value. And that is, if your son is killed or your wife dies, how you react to that and what the police see is a huge factor as to whether they think that you're involved or not.
Right.
And, you know, the first thing I would say is that you've never seen this person react to another tragedy before.
Right.
So what is your baseline for deciding whether this person is acting appropriately or not? Some people cry. Some people say nothing. I mean, there's no, and I've done quite a bit of research on this whole mourning thing, because mourning as in right. being upset, that,
apparently, you know, happens every day.
Right, exactly.
I try to avoid both.
And so it's just, it's something interesting to me because it's one of those things can really lead an investigation astray is that someone is not reacting in a manner that the police think is consistent with someone dealing with coping with a loss. And Brad certainly fell into that area.
Right. So what did he end up pleading guilty to? First-degree murder or second-degree
I think it was second-degree murder. And I think he has about, I would say, 4 to 6 years left to serve.
So what is your opinion? That he didn't do it at all or that he probably did do it but not for malicious reasons?
My opinion... I don't think he did it. There's one piece of evidence that convicted him, and it's a valid piece of evidence. But outside of that, there is nothing that points to him doing it. And I can't conceive of a way how he could have done it. Like if you walk through the timeline and everything and how he could have pulled this off and what he needed to do to accomplish it, I can't figure it out. Mm-hmm. But the piece of evidence that they had was a Google Maps search on his computer. And it was it's a very compelling piece of information, and I'm no computer forensics, and I did a lot of research, and I still don't fully understand it. But basically, there was a 42-second search on his work computer the day before she went missing of the location where she was found. Mm. And that is a pretty incriminating piece of evidence. However, the police failed to do two things that it's deplorable to me that they didn't do them, and it's just inexcusable. And that is, they were told by the FBI to verify the search with Google, because basically you have what's on the computer, but Google could verify that search took place from a given portal. So they would know that his Cisco office where he was sitting is where that search took place. Mm-hmm. They never did that. And then they also never went to Cisco and had them verify that search went over their router. Mm-hmm. And so the claim is that it was planted on his computer. And that would be very easily have refuted had they done anything to corroborate the only piece of information they really had that tied him to this murder.
What would be the motive for them to plant that?
I don't think the police planted it, but someone did.
Okay. Right.
Shaded and faded. I do
sell
a lot,
sell it, woman.
I do a lot of abstract work. I do a lot of figure paintings, mostly canvas work. I also do some custom furniture, and I did the Wait What If podcast table,
which I'll get some pictures on Facebook so people can see it. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that'd be super cool. That'd be great.
Yeah, when I say pretty cool, I mean it's really cool, because when you turn out, if we were out here with it, it would be glowing. Did you see those inlays?
I did
the
not.
Blue. Okay, so yeah.
It's incredible.
It's one of those wire spools. The top is mm-hmm. from the wire spool, and then she had taken a Dremel and drilled out to make it look like almost like a wormwood type of thing. Like,
yeah. And then all of the rot and everything. And then I filled it in with a photoluminescent resin. So in the
that's
ambient
what I
light or in the complete dark, of course.
Glow in the dark.
That was my first guess.
Know,
I like
we
to
know
simplify
about
it.
Photoluminescent. Usually it's, you know, blood glows in the dark. But hey, a table, that's cool too. But yes, yeah, so in it absorbs whatever natural or artificial light it gets, and then it has a subtle glow in the inlays.
It doesn't really show up on the podcast much, though, right?
When we get to our video podcast.
Nope. It's more of an implied
it's
glow.
It's theater yeah. of the mind,
yeah.
man.
Yeah.
I start off all my shows, I go, end scene.
Yeah.
Picture, four people sitting around a table. Crickets, planes flying over. The moon is half full.
Yes.
The table has an ambient glow.
You have to be here to see this. Yes. This is really incredible.
It's fantastic.
You're missing it.
That's right.
What I want to
really
do, I don't know.
You're missing it.
It was sunny when you got here. Back there, I have a little fire pit that I made. And what I want to do is, and it looks like just by how far we're sitting apart right now, that we could go back there, especially as the summer fades away and there's not as many bugs, and do a podcast, which
just
would be
kind of
nice.
Watch the wires on the fire, because right now they're all
you are right.
Tables,
you are so, right.
I mean, something to consider.
Mm-hmm. I will put that. Uh-huh. But it's a gas one, so I don't actually build the fire. I just
true story.
Yeah. So that's Shade and Fade. How can they contact you? Suppose, let's say this. Let's say I want a nude painting of myself over my fireplace. How would I contact you?
Wow, I was getting ready to stick my hand up and say, oh, I do those kinds of things. But no, I don't do so many nude paintings of Kevin Sullivan. But I normally do women, abstract nude figure painting. And you can go to facebook.com, Shaded and Faded. Or you can look up Malia Christie, Shaded and Faded, Malia Christie Artist, and it'll take you right there. If you see a picture of a nude woman, you've probably found the right place.
Or you're on, what's the, whitehouse.com? Yeah. If you're on the internet and you found a nude woman, you're on your website.
Ugh. Oh, gosh.
I think you might be on another, but.
So you've got a lot of websites out there.
Most of the internet.
You can internet. Find me on the blotter, on Tinder.
Originally designed by the U.S. government to for spies to communicate, and since then been taken over by the porn industry. And Mike, you're up.
Your plug time.
Your plug time.
Yep, sorry. What's happening? I have two episodes out right now for Make It a Double, which is all about booze, spirits, history, mixology, and the people and stories that make it great. Episode one is on moonshine. We talked to Jeremy Norris of Broad Slab Distilleries in Benson, North Carolina. He goes through his whole story, how he found out about moonshining. It dates really all the way back to the mid-1800s when his great-great-grandfather first started distilling his own whiskeys. Now, they were all farmers, and they had all this extra corn, and they didn't know what to do with it. And, well, distilling whiskey and those sorts of things kind of went hand-in-hand with agriculture back then since they had all this extra corn. And that's pretty neat. So he kind of talks to that story and then talks about his grandfather and Prohibition and the ATU and leaving town for 20 years to avoid
What's the
going
ATU? Alcohol, tobacco?
You know, it's a good unit. Question and I don't remember. I've been drinking a little bit myself, so I can't remember all the facts.
Former government employee using acronyms and not... Yeah.
That's pretty standard, though. We all...
Yeah.
Lots of acronyms. ATU, and we
GBU, MNOP.
But so we talked to him, and he talks to his story, and then we have a friend of mine out in California who's basically a modern-day moonshiner since it's still illegal in all 50 states to distill your own liquor, and kind of hear his perspective. And then we talked to Rick Morris, who's the president of the Hobby Distillers Association, which is an organization that seeks to educate lawmakers and Americans, hopefully to overturn the law to allow folks like me and you to go about distilling our own spirits in our home the same way folks can now brew their own beer and make their own wine. So it's a pretty interesting episode. It's pretty full. It's about 50 minutes. So if you're commuting to or from work, I think it's a good little listen. And then episode two is on craft beer, which is also very exciting. But the moonshine one was a lot of fun.
We listened to it on the way to South Carolina last week. And what I want to tell the listeners, it's like a audio... Well, it's like, I was going to say an audio NPR. Well, it's, Mike does a really good job at taking a few interviews and bringing them together and telling a story. Plus, you do a good job with the mics and picking up the background noises, walking through the woods or wherever you're walking to look at the old stills. And
was that intentional?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it worked out pretty good.
Yeah, the production quality is amazing. So while I'm doing all my artwork, I truly
don't
do.
Don't piggyback
no,
on his.
I was going to give you guys like props. When I'm painting, that's my time to be kind of free and in my zone. And usually I listen to music, but for the last month, I listened to the Wait What If and the Make It a Double podcast.
Hooray.
Thank you very much.
I don't know. Creativity feeds off creativity.
I got some pretty neat ones coming out, I think. There's a mixology one, then the one with you two, which... That's dangerous.
You can't
I'm
just
not entirely
win
sure.
all the time. Sometimes yeah, right. you gotta have some failures.
The problem with that one is I remember towards the end of the night we were singing along to the Wu-Tang Clan.
That's not going to,
and that's not
cut.
Good for anyone because we're going to run for president someday.
Allegedly, it's never
probably
going to
cut that out.
Necessarily,
but one I'm really looking forward to is the Irish Traditions episode that I've been working on right now. Which is really neat. We're going to talk Irish whiskey, Irish beer, Irish drinking songs, Irish songs, Ireland, leprechauns. It's all in there. It's going to be
so racist. We're more proud people than that.
No, well, fairies.
fairies in Ireland, it's like a serious thing. You
I know.
It scares
them. I've been to Ireland, and I remember the, one of the questions for our tour guide when I did the Southern Ireland tour was, hey, what's the situation with leprechauns? He's like, leprechauns, you know, whatever. They don't exist. And but fairies. Fairies yeah. are real.
They're, and it's F-A-E-R.
He's like, something. You don't mess yeah, with fairies. And then he was pointing out fairy circles out.
Fairy mounds.
Well, he said circles.
Oh, he was a liar. I'm just kidding.
We'll find him and beat him up, I guess, before lying to me. But evidently, he was...
Yeah, they don't go near him. Farmers won't go near fairy mounds or circles.
He was not screwing around. That was serious business.
I have toddlers, and they watch Tinkerbell all day long. No. So it's
these fairies
circles.
Are angry.
These are like, yeah, mean
fairy circles.
Mean.
Tinkerbell said it.
These aren't Julia Roberts floating around with
Sound of Music
Robin Williams.
Or whatever.
No, that was on Hook.
Whatever.
All right, so let's get back to the show. Oh, and then, of course, John Taylor at... Well, do you want to plug your site?
Yeah, truecrimewriting.com. That's okay. My website.
And then you can find your books on Amazon.
Amazon.com through my website, or if you go directly to Amazon and put in the titles, Isolated Incident or Umbrella of Suspicion, both okay. of those will come up.
Very good. Hopefully we get some, let's see, at least 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 34 people checking out your website, so that'll be good. That was my joke about how we don't have that many listeners, but...
I don't know. Combined now?
No, we do all right. We do all right. Combined. Right now we're at... my latest episode was... It's about 300, and that number goes up every week. So when the new episodes come out, people listen to the old episodes, I guess. And I don't know why 300 people want to listen to the three of us sit around and well, four with guests.
Thank you.
Just
I think
for the fact that when we have fantastic guests,
I
talk
think
about
300 people would listen to John.
Well, let's back this up for a minute. Prior to John and prior to the ghost hunter, it was us just chatting, and then I decided to reach out and get guests, and yeah. and now that's why we're getting more people.
It's become more official.
It's more official. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You started out with
more interesting
less official
now.
Guests who are extremely knowledgeable on particular things. Then you started getting into the whole, wow, we've got a neighborhood filled with interesting people. Yeah. Like you guys, for example. And then it just sort of took a turn. I like that you're getting back now to people who really do know things about things.
I like you put a microphone in front of your mouth. That means you know what you're talking about. You didn't realize that?
Absolutely.
That's a truth of life.
Allegedly.
All right. So so we were talking while we were off the air, and Mike was in there chatting and doing whatever Mike does.
Hanging out with your wife.
So there's
Whoa, hey,
easy. Now.
Don't you be starting things.
Insinuative. By the way, I have a journalism degree.
Oh, nice. So you appreciated my comments earlier?
I heard what you said about... No, in fact, that's why... And I was in advertising and marketing, and that was always the roadblock for me was that... So, wait a minute. I love to write, and I appreciate... the creative journalism and investigative reporting, but the sensationalism and the we'll say whatever it takes to get viewers or to sell products.
Well, let's talk about sensationalism.
I couldn't do that.
I think that was a question I had sent to you about, I think, or maybe did I pick it up from your website where you wanted to stay away from sensation.
Well, I do try to avoid sensationalizing the crimes I'm dealing with. I mean, obviously, the facts themselves are enough. They're usually pretty shocking, pretty horrific. There's nothing... I'm not trying to do anything to make anything any more compelling than the facts themselves. Mm-hmm. And if anything, I usually go into something that's less sensationalized, like the linguistics or, I mean, even dealing with... the motive or something like that, which anything that's kind of just more analytical around a given case.
So what I had sent you was sensationalism was limited prior to, I guess, the recent 24-hour news cycle. I think that phenomena is bringing up the idea of sensationalism. So when I was growing up, I remember my dad and mom watching the news at like I think it was on at 7:30 at night, and it would be Tom Brokaw or what was the other one that
Peter Jennings.
Who was the? It was Brokaw.
Dan Rather. Walter Cronkite.
Yeah. Well, no, I think that was before.
Walter yeah, that's a while Cronkite. Ago.
Yeah, but so they would watch
you're
that
old
at night,
though, right?
Cronkite. This is when this side of the room starts to derail, and it always has to do with what they're doing right here. But
yeah.
No, I think we're just letting our
legs fly. I noticed the. So it would be a half hour. It'd be a half hour to be national news, and then there would be a half hour of local news, and they could fill it because you only have a half hour to talk about things, and you had commercials and stuff to put in there. And then when the 24-hour news cycle came around, you need to fill 24 hours a day. And originally, when CNN first came out, it was like maybe 6 hours and just repeat. It would just repeat. It was almost like headline news. Right. Headline news, it's like 15-minute segments, and you only have to watch 15 minutes. It's just going to repeat throughout the day. Now, I think what happened is, you know, they realized that they're getting people watching this serial almost like you would watch a TV show. It almost became newsertainment, right? People are glued to their TV sets, and then the old adage, if it bleeds, it leads. So you have things like Jean Benet, or you have things like these killings, you know, the mass shootings that we're seeing, where and this is a fact. In the general scope of existence today, we are living in a very nonviolent time. It seems counterintuitive considering every time you turn on the news, there's some sort of violent crime happening.
Right.
But in general, in the scheme of human history, your odds of dying violently are not that high, I mean, depending on where you live. But still, in the era of Darfur, in the era of ISIS and Iraq and Iran, all those, it's still not a very violent time. But if it bleeds, it leads. They have to put it on TV to draw you into it. Same thing with mass weather or horrible weather events. It's really not the case,
right?
And I think it has to do with sensationalism.
Absolutely. If there's one thing that's missing from news or that realm is kind of like a not just perspective, but like a grounding. So if they're talking about shark attacks and they're just like, oh, there's a shark attack, you know, every week. They don't follow up with, well, on average, every year, there are 72 shark attacks a year or whatever. So they never give you that. Or they never say, you know, it's 100 degrees, but it averages 99 every year.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They leave that part off. They probably because they don't know. But and the same thing with the murders. It's certainly not interesting to follow up with how many murders are occurring in New York City right now with this is, you know, 82% below what it was in the 90s. You know, I mean, like that's just not something they're going to talk about.
Yeah, they've gone down, even with gun crime, right? Isn't it dropped drastically from where it was in the 70s and 80s?
Yes, and the 90s and even the early 2000s. I mean, crime is down. It may be up a little bit in the last couple years from those lower numbers, but overall, the trend is significantly lower. And yeah, it's an argument that I have, you know, with my mother all the time as far as she's retired. And the downside of being retired is that people watch the news all the time, so they have all these ideas about what's going on in the world,
right?
And that was one of them that my mom was just shocked that there are less murders today than there were 20 years ago in the United States, because if you watch the news you would never believe that.
Absolutely no. What are your thoughts on, and again, I don't know if it is so much a growing issue or if it's what the news wants us to know, but what are your thoughts on this growing concern and from what we see in the news of these mass killings? I mean, just yesterday, it's perfect timing for this. The man, I don't know if you saw the guy who went up with the two reporters and shot them in cold blood. What are your thoughts on these mass killings?
It certainly sounds like it appears that those are becoming more prevalent. That's not just the media. I mean, they're reporting every one of them, but it seems to be a more common occurrence. And I'm not sure. I mean, when I think about it, I think that they're looking for, it's an attention seeking behavior. It's they're wanting to commit suicide. They're wanting to do something. They're very desperate. And this is something they know they can get attention by doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to get media attention. And so before people were, I don't know, killing their own family and killing themselves, mm-hmm. they're going out into public. They're doing these things in movie theaters. They're doing things that get that kind of respect that they didn't get when they were alive.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. That's kind of my thought on why it's occurring. I don't know why it's occurring more now.
Can I ask what bothers you more? That there are mass killings around the world for what they feel are great purposes to get attention, or that there are just murders that are taking place in our country that are unsolved and that, you know, people are going free? I don't know.
I'm not. I'm not a fan of either one. I guess I would say.
Of course not.
You know, on a total number scale, he's like Ed McMahon over here.
I know.
His job is to laugh at Kevin.
But my original thought was I wanted to say, how do you feel about our own country's law enforcement and investigating the FBI? But I was like, you know, no one wants to put someone on the spot and ask them that. So I tried to make it a little more gentle. But
yeah, I mean, I think in general, law enforcement does a great job. I think that most people in law enforcement are very respectable, good people that try to do the right thing. There certainly are a few bad apples out there, and they've gotten a lot of attention lately. But as far as solving crimes, I haven't looked. The solve rate, like on murders, it's not nearly as high. I think it was around 50% at one time, and I think that's pretty consistent over time. So, yeah, I mean, I certainly – it is not a comforting thought to think that there are that many people walking around who have committed murder. I guess I would take comfort in thinking that, you know, most people that do that don't just do it once, and they probably get caught at some point. So I'd say a lot of those people are probably in jail for other crimes. But, right. Yeah, it's certainly not good for the victims for them to not realize or not know, not the victims that have been killed, but the victims' families,
right.
that you know, that somebody that's murdered a loved one has not been, you know, put in prison.
Right.
So were you saying that it's more creepy to have people where it's not sensationalized, that's going on out there, there's a murder, someone gets away with it, versus the Boston bomber who is on the cover of Rolling Stone and people know about?
No, what I was insinuating, or at least positing, was that there are people who very blatantly, they wear it on the bomb strapped on their chest. Here's what I'm doing this because this is what I believe in, and I want people to know about it. That is what it is. They've made their point. What is intriguing and maybe a little scary about just us as people is that there are much smaller or hidden reasons why people kill other people, and they're not looking for the attention or the recognition. They're looking to truly not be caught.
I see. The motive of being of taking someone out
for my own little personal
becoming
reason.
Famous for it.
I don't want to, and I'd love to get away with it.
Well, therein lies the whole idea of the monster that's among us. You know, there you can debate whether there's ghosts or aliens or monsters or Bigfoot, but you can't debate whether there's psychopaths out there that will take your life because you're in their way.
Right.
You're just a pawn in their end game.
I guess to put it
that's terrifying.
More
simply, it's a terrifying thing to think about.
There are people who will kill people and you know, die for it, and get all their riches and glory in heaven. But there are people who will kill people and want to live out the rest of their lives, hopefully never getting caught for it.
Right.
I don't know. Something about that is just really chilling and disappointing about people.
I'm surprised evolutionarily, we haven't weeded those folks out yet, because the whole idea, and again, without getting into theology or anything like that, if we think specifically on the evolutionary level, morals and conscience plays a role in group dynamics. It if you have an individual who was I talking to you about this? I was talking to someone about this just recently. If you have an individual that hoards the meat or steals the food or kills to better himself, as a group, that doesn't work. And if you're shunned from the group, or if you're outside the group and stealing from them, your chances of survival are lower than the group dynamic. So over time, let's say 50,000 years, those individuals who had that, we'll call it the selfish gene was it Dawkins, the selfish
Richard
gene?
Richard Dawkins.
Yeah. So with the selfish gene, those people get, basically, they die out. And now we have the development of morals and consciousness, or at least group morals and consciousness, or conscience. Why that hasn't disappeared yet? I mean, now we're back to the nature and the nurture version of it. And then children are raised with maladaptive, well, they're raised in bad environments. They have what's called maladaptive, not talk on the clinical level, but they have patterns of behavior that make up for their lack of being raised correctly. And it's those maladaptive behaviors that turn into personality disorders, which turn into psychopaths, sociopaths, antisocial personality, ODD.
So you think it comes more from the environment?
I think it's much more from the environment, but I also think that you can raise a person completely normal, and there's that genetic flaw where, and it could be within the family itself. But yeah, I mean, just looking at the development of personality disorders, and they're calling psychopathy or psychopathness, which isn't a term, but that's what psychopathy is, as a personality disorder.
Right.
And personality disorders come about from maladaptive behaviors. Those behaviors by maladaptive, I mean to grow and to mature into who you are. Everyone comes up with defense mechanisms. Everyone comes up with whatever they deem necessary to survive. And in a good family, you still come up with those. Everyone, I mean, and it could be anything. It could be you were small at school, or you were the youngest in a family, or you know, whatever it is. But in a violent family, in an alcoholic family, in a family with a psychopathic father or mother, those patterns of behavior, whether it's to go out in public and bring attention to yourself, or the opposite, to hide within groups of people and I guess act more as a predator, those are adaptive behaviors to make up for a shortcoming.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is some validity to that, and because we're looking for answers. How does this happen? Where do they come from? But, you know, there are hundreds of thousands of people who come from violent homes and alcoholic parents and have all those things that never hurt a soul.
That's true.
Right? And there are people that are serial killers that their siblings are not. Mm-hmm. And they had the exact same genes and they grew up in the exact same environment. Mm-hmm. So how do you explain? You know, it's like, I don't know what to do with that. And I know that, you know, it's one of those things when they capture a serial killer, they've got checklists. They ask them, you know, were you abused as a child? Did this happen? And obviously those are kind of leading questions, right? The person's got to be thinking, well, you must think these things happened because that's why I did this. And, you know, did you have head trauma as a kid? Did you burn things? Did you hurt animals? They're asking all these questions. So they're obviously, and then they'll be like, well, serial killers seem to have more of these. Well, it's like, those are the questions you're asking.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, like, that's you didn't true. Ask them what their favorite color was, so we don't know. So it's like
black, kinda,
right? Yeah,
black.
But
gray.
It's a troubling thing, you know. When I got your list of questions or statements, that was I'm tossing that around, and I don't know. I think it's more environment than it is genetic becoming, say, a psychopath, but that still doesn't explain it.
What do you think about the genetic aspect? Like I was saying, group behaviors. If you're on the outskirts, your chances of surviving aren't very good.
Do you mean the evolutionary part of it?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, logically it makes sense, but I think it's more complicated than that.
Yeah.
I mean, if you just look at it, I mean, there are so many problems we have in society that are predominantly genetic that are new. And that clearly they have not been, we're not getting better as a society evolution-wise. So there are things, and we are fostering some of those, right? Like we don't shun the bad people anymore. So we're almost doing the opposite in some way. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because I mean, as we evolve as a society, somebody has a deformity, you don't want to kick them out into, you know, and let them die. You take care of them. That's what we do. But obviously, you know, that's the right thing to do, but that's allowing that person to grow up, and then maybe they have children, and you could be, you know, continuing that issue. So, I mean, I don't know. I think that it's part of it, but I don't know. I think it's more complicated than that.
Well, have you ever heard of, I think his name was H.H. Miller or B.B. Miller or B.D. Miller, back in the 1800s, he was...
I'm not that old.
He was, back when you were a child,
yeah.
You were...
Back in the 80s.
Pushing the kids used to...
Yeah, no, the 1880s.
He was, I guess, one of the first serial killers. And his story is so terrifying that it's hard to believe it even happened. He didn't... He had I want to say it was a hotel or a brothel or something that he had... He had purposely altered the rooms. He had staircases that led to nowhere,
right,
where people would fall in. This is a true story. And I think he killed hundreds of people or up there. I mean, it was.
Yeah, they're not sure. Yeah, I think it was H.H. I can't remember what his name was.
H.H.
But
I
remember looking at, they have like a online, you can look at a model of his house, because he had all these hidden stairways and dungeons and trap rooms, and he would, you know, put people in those, and it's very disturbing.
Right.
And it's one of those things, like, back then, you know, the when you had a picture taken, you had to stand still for like an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So the people never smile in the picture. They have to just deadpan it. And so any picture of him, he just, you know, you're already thinking he's, you know, messed up or has issues, and you just look at this picture and it's just, it's that much worse.
I wish I remember the name of the guy right now, but
what about before that? Wasn't Elizabeth Bathory? Are you familiar?
Elizabeth who?
Bathory.
Lizzie Gordon? Lizzie Borden?
Are you thinking Lizzie Borden?
No. Bathory? Bathory.
Do you have a lisp right now? Is your tongue asleep?
B-A-T-H-O-R-Y, I believe.
P-A-T-H-O-R.
B.
She used to look her up. Googles it. Googles it. GTS. GTS it. She brought young girls in, and she would torture them, and she would bathe in their blood because she thought the blood would keep her young.
Ooh.
She was a huge serial killer.
I'm not.
Lived in a castle.
This either has to be true, or look her up. You need to get out right now.
Yeah, that is actually. I don't want to sleep tonight now. Thank you.
Look her up. It's crazy. Are you looking it up?
Actually.
And so, yeah, he may not have been the first, but he was H.H., I can't think of his last name either. But
Cooper? Was it Cooper? God, I don't even know. P.T. Barnum.
Yeah. He had a circus.
With all the...
But it was the numbers of people that he supposedly killed. It was kind of like he was
poisoned
the
them,
first
gassed and, them.
Yeah.
And, yeah, it was some terrible stuff.
You are on point with the H.H. What's-his-face. I feel like we can just believe everything John says. And you, Mike, are correct. Elizabeth Bathory.
Wow, look at that.
Nice. So he even spelled
up?
It.
What's up? I did spell
and
it.
And I'm the smartest person I know, so.
So tell me about Elizabeth Bathory.
When was it? What year was this?
1560 to 1614 was her life.
Now look what she used to do.
But the question is, back then, where things were a little bit weirder, you know, I mean,
she used to put girls in cages with spikes on them. And then rock the cage.
Was that weird back then?
Into it.
Yeah. Was that considered weird?
That could have been normal. We don't know.
You never know.
She was a mistress. Hey, so it's whatever you're into.
Maybe it is.
If that was wrong, you know, somebody would have
told them. It's the time of the Iron Maiden, remember.
It's true.
Not the Iron Maiden, but
the actual torture device.
Yeah. So is there anything that we didn't touch upon that you were interested in bringing up?
I mean, there's a lot of topics. We kind of touched on motive. That's one that's interesting to me as far as cases, not serial killers. That's one of them where you kind of know what the motive is, which is just that they're not connected with us kind of thing.
Right.
But cases where a husband kills a wife or a neighbor, you know, shoots another neighbor. And one of the things, you know, the prosecution is always fixated on proving motive, which is not an element that you have to prove in criminal court. And it always, one is that it's not something you can ever prove because you never know. And two is they always try to make it simplistic as far as that it was for money or they were getting divorced, whatever. It's one thing or two things. When, if you think about your motivation for doing most things, especially if it's something, you know, why you took a job, there are many, many facets to your reasoning behind it. And there's also some that are subconscious that you may not even be fully aware of. And I find that they spend so much time on the motive, which doesn't really give them anything. And a lot of times it brings in parts of the case that are very interesting to us as observers, but have nothing to do with the case, you know, whether the person actually committed the murder. So motive is one of those things to me that's, it's a really touchy area. It's people want to know why, but it's, you're never going to know that. So
it's not black and white. It's basically,
you're trying to prove something you can't prove.
Right.
You're just going to speculate and you're probably wrong. And then you're going to be bringing in things that really have nothing to do with it. You know, as far as, I don't know, the person had an affair or something and somehow that's a factor.
Someone's trying to prove a case or guilt or, you know, lack thereof. We have to do it based on the laws that we have. So it's, even though our motives could be a million and one, they have to say, well, it falls within one of these particular motives because that's what legally we can prove or disprove.
Well, they just have to improve intent. They don't have to improve motive.
Right.
So the motive is because people want to know. So, and I don't disagree. I mean, if I'm on a jury, that's probably one of the things I want to know. But it's not necessary to convict someone to have motive. But right. it's one of those things that it becomes, I mean, I don't know if you ever watch like Law and Order, every single episode they have no evidence and they just go in on motive. And it's like, that's what they're trying to prove on. And in a lot of cases, I feel like it's such a strong factor, yet it's not tangible and it's not something that you can really prove. Right. You know, we get back to the discussion of, you know, a relationship. And if you're trying to prove that they had the husband and wife had a terrible relationship, well, you know, that, what are you going to pull in friends? You're going to look at emails? I mean, think of emails you send, you know, with your spouse or friends. There's all kinds of meaning that's in innuendo that if someone else read it, right. they would not have any idea what you guys are talking about, or they would misconstrue it. And now that stuff's going into court.
Where they were saying it, in taking things like that are emotional or situational literally, or trying to use it in a literal sense of just like, God, that guy drives me nuts. I could just kill him.
Right.
And, you know, in a court of law, that can actually go against you. You know,
well, yeah, if you're
kidding.
He's dead.
And they're like, we don't care.
Right.
You said it.
What are your thoughts on free will?
On free will in just in general, or like so, within the legal system? Or
so individual gets into a fender bender. He goes to his car, he pulls out his gun, and he shoots the person who he hits. Where, and this is a topic that we're going to talk about with Paul Adams down the road here.
The philosopher.
Mm-hmm. Who, he's a Christian apologist, so his idea of free will is obviously, there's a confirmation bias towards that mm-hmm. side of things. But then there's also the neuropathic free will where, you know, I had just read Sam Harris's book actually called Free Will, which talks about basically the complete lack of free will. Not that there are no monsters in the world that pull out their gun after a fender bender and kill someone, but how deep does the fault lay within the person? You take a person that's brought up a certain way, so you add these long-standing maladaptive behaviors, just to keep using that term, combined with any sort of recent behaviors or recent things that are going on with them, whether it be something as acute as low blood sugar or right. a recent argument with the girlfriend, you combine all those things together, it puts the act of murder or the act of anything, even the idea of you raising your arm, if you had a choice between raise your right or raise your left, into complete lack of free will. That it just happens because something is put into motion that is way beyond your control, and you're just basically an actor on the stage.
So under that premise, would you say that you could predict the behavior then based on that?
I guess in theory, if you had all the variables.
All the inputs?
Yeah, you wouldn't be able to get all the inputs. But I mean, maybe you
theoretically.
Could. Yeah. I guess in a simulation.
I would say, because that's kind of what I was getting from what you were saying, that, and, you know, I guess what I would say, I mean, theoretically I understand that, but I don't agree with it. I mean, I think that if you had every single input and you came to that same point in time where the person gets a fender bender, you'd have no better chance of 50-50 of guessing what that person's going to do.
Right.
That even with all those inputs. I think that what you're doing is you're saying that he shot this guy, and then you're backing up, and mm-hmm. you're saying, okay, now look at all these things that led to that. Well, of course, this was the natural progression. Well, it's only the natural progression because that's what happened.
When he got to that point, though, did he have the choice, or did he just act on motions that began even prior to he was born?
And that's possible. And there certainly are factors there that could contribute to that. But the closer you get to impulse, the less control I'd say you have. But in general, you know, I think the person has a lot of control. But I see what you're saying, that there are things that within you, like that you get in an argument with somebody and then you walk up to somebody else. Well, you're going to be much more likely to get into an argument with that second person, at least right. you would think, because you're already agitated and you misattribute what this person is doing based on what you already experienced. So I certainly think there is some determinism there. But, you know, my concern, just from a practical standpoint, is that when you start going down the line of determinism, you start taking away accountability from people. That's where people right. naturally go on a practical level.
Yeah, and that's where people also have a little bit of distaste when you talk about free will and whether it's real or not, is because right. they seem to think it's shifting the blame. which in a way I guess it is, but in a way it isn't, because you still, you know, a person who goes up and shoots someone because they got into a car accident has no business being on the street. He needs to be locked up, and I don't even know. I mean, we can talk about rehabilitation. That would be a completely different – that would be another couple hours of discussion. But I think that's where people have the distaste for it. But I think it's a fascinating subject, and I think it plays a big role into really our daily lives. And there's two complete separate thoughts. I mean, there's probably more than that, but then you have the people who say, no, it's predetermined, which would be more of the theological aspect of it, or it's predetermined by everything that has happened to you from this point prior, or every moment in your life, doesn't matter what you were brought up with, you have a free choice.
Right. I'm always amazed by people that believe that, yet are still motivated.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if I believe that everything was predetermined, I wouldn't do anything. I would just assume it's going to happen. Like, if I'm meant to do it, I'll do it. Like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't feel that way, so I don't know. But that's kind of how I see it. I just, if you think that everything's already been decided, it's just, to me, it would be very hard to put a lot of time into a thought or a decision or to want to go to college or want to get a job. I'd just be like, no, I don't need to.
Right.
That's going to work itself out somehow.
Well, if you sat on the couch like that, then I guess that is your...
That's your, yeah.
That's the answer.
Exactly.
So,
chicken or the egg there, I guess.
What are your plans for the future? Are you working on anything right now as far as crime goes, or crime writing?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
good thing keeps happening.
I'm looking at
thinking of my next felonies. I'm definitely terrified to drive home tonight after all these scenarios of people getting in fender benders.
It's a great community. Feel free to stay over. Not at my house.
One of the things, I'm not currently working on anything writing-wise. I've been doing a lot of research into the psychopath, the sociopath arena, looking at that, for my next project, and also doing some shorter articles on current events, current true crime that's going on in different angles there. And then another thing I want to get more involved in is I like to test different theories and do things and see how it plays out in real life versus what you would envision. One example I would give was with the Brad Cooper case. The prosecutors in Wake County, and I have no idea how they came up with this idea, but Nancy, when she was found, when she was dead, found dead, her sports bra was pulled up around her, above her breasts, like underneath her armpits.
I remember reading there was some issue with the sports bra.
And so the theory was that Brad tried to put the sports bra on her or something, but he wasn't able to, and that's why it was up there, and this was somehow, you know, evidence that he killed her. And they had this woman who was just like a friend of Nancy's testify, like she as some kind of expert in putting on sports bras, saying how impossible it is to put on a woman's sports bra. And and so that is a fairly common assumption among women.
Impossible to take off, am I right, guys?
Exactly.
Well, like, hey. No, I'm just kidding, sorry.
For this book, I tested it out, and I wanted to see how fast I could put a sports bra on a woman.
Wait, you're kidding?
No, I'm serious.
Oh, really?
And it was surprisingly easy.
Okay.
And assuming the woman's dead, so you could have her arms straight, and you just put on a sports bra.
How did you do this experiment?
It was challenging. It was very easy to do, and I was shocked that here they are in court talking about how difficult that is to do. And
did you have a friend just
volunteer to do it? And so it was something that just, it's not that hard to do, but it seems like it would be.
Right.
And it's actually, I think, easier for someone else to put one on someone than it is themselves.
Wow.
But so there's just a lot of things. Another one is like breaking glass that about, I don't know, about 30% of glass, if you break a window, actually falls on the same side that you're on versus the other side.
Right, yeah.
Because most people would think if you break glass that all the glass would shatter onto the other side, but that's not the case, because whatever you use to break the glass, when you pull it back through, you pull glass with it, so a lot of the glass will fall on both sides. So you'll read a lot in cases that people will say, well, we think it was done inside the house, that the person, you know, pretended like there was an intruder because they broke the glass, there was glass on the outside, but that's not true. It could be either side.
What are your long-term goals? I mean, are you going to continue to study and write? Do you want to teach? Do you what are your thoughts?
I just want to continue to write and improve my craft within writing. I want to keep it as a hobby. I think if I tried to make money, one, I can't imagine making enough to live off of, but it's something that it changes the dynamic of what you're doing if you have to make money off. It's not as enjoyable, in my opinion. So I'd like to keep it as a hobby. I would like to keep putting out books. I would like to get much more involved in the cases that I write about, and hopefully I certainly would love to be able to solve one or more unsolved cases and help families, you know, come to peace with what has happened to them.
And as far as your podcast, where can people reach that?
That's it, twistedpodcast.com, but they could also get it through my website at truecrimewriting.com. But that's something that another writer and I, he's in the crime fiction arena, that he and I are kind of testing the waters there, looking at different true crime cases, doing analysis, and just kind of discussing the different cases and what makes them interesting, and we're trying to focus on like landmark cases or cases where we can pull something out of it besides the case, some other element that's interesting to society or to, you know, the darker side of human nature.
Are you guys sharing in the editing, or is he doing the editing, or
he is doing the editing? Mm-hmm. I would say that I'm sharing like my moral support. But yeah. Since you guys are talking about how hard the editing is, I kind of feeling a little guilty about that.
It's just what happens is you start with the show. And then every single show I do, I leave and I'm like, oh my gosh, what did I talk about? And then you listen to it. And if you put it together, and Mike knows this painfully true because of all the hours he spent on his, you think your show is crap. When you're done, you're like, that show is crap. But someone who hasn't listened to it, if you put the time in and you don't even have to do that much editing. You just make it sound professional, unless you're doing the documentary type of show that Mike's doing. But if you're doing just the free form talk show, you take out the whatever the garbage that's in there, which isn't that hard to do. But it's the
you no, haven't listened to this one yet.
There's the.
You're saying the first part of the show is edited much better than the last part, is
absolutely
what you're saying.
It's usually the middle. I kind of, because the last part I always try to keep somewhat.
The other thing about it, if you're doing something more like mine that I've struggled with, is voiceovers. There's a lot of time.
And talking close enough to the microphone is another problem.
Probably. Well, I don't generally have this problem. I don't set four microphones up. If I have two mics, it comes in a little different. But when you're doing voiceovers, if you're trying to mash a few things together that don't quite fit and you're trying to make a good transition or segue, man, I'll write this script and I'll read it, I don't know, 15, 20 times, different ways into the microphone and record it and listen to myself. And you're always your biggest critic.
Yeah, you'll never.
And it's terrible.
You'll never like what you do.
Yeah, and then you'll read it and you'll think, this sounds stupid. Let me take this word out or put that word in or change this sentence around. And man, I've done that so many times just to create one episode. The amount of, and I don't get paid nothing for this, but it consumes so much of
if you were paid
time.
By the hour, you'd do well.
Holy shit. Oh, I wouldn't be living here. I'd be living at the nines.
I imagine you probably get hit with the same ideas when you're editing a book, when you're working through a book. I mean, you must look at your writing and go, oh, man, is this what I want to say? And then how does that go?
Do you do your own editing?
Actually, he'd probably be very good at podcasting then, since he's already an author and writes and
the editing
own,
part?
Yeah, do you do the editing part?
I do, but I have to have someone else edit at some point. You just... Right. You don't read every word, and you get so used to what you know what you want to say, so you can't pick up on what's actually said, kind of thing. So yeah, you certainly, I would always recommend having someone else as an editor over whatever you're initially doing.
I'm not a writer, and I'm not a podcaster, but as an artist, it's tough because you're your author, your editor, and you're never ever happy with the finished product ever.
Even with the I like the abstract concept, just because I feel like that you can't go wrong with that, right?
I was talking to you about this. Mm-hmm. Like I don't feel like there's any right or wrong art. I think that everyone's an artist, and I told Mike, of course, he disagreed with me on this, but I'm like, the only reason I make any profit off of it is because I think that not everyone has figured out that they're amazing artists. Everyone's afraid to I make money off of I do what I do off of talent and passion, but I make money off of fear, because if everyone just lost their fear of screwing up, they'd all be amazing artists and there would never be anything to sell. But That's from an abstract point of view, where it's art and it's never really complete or ever over. I can only imagine having something published and then I would read over it a million times and be like, oh, it's not right. It's not right.
Yeah, I'm charging you for a second plug. All right, okay, so
that's fine.
Let's wrap it up.
I brought over 2 pounds of bacon, so
that's wow. Right. Is it still? Is there any left, Mike?
I don't know. I ate quite a bit of it. I'm not even talking anymore.
All right, so that was Way Way of Podcast number 15. We had John Taylor, true crime author. You can check him out on truecrimewriting.com. Check out his books on Amazon. We also have Shaded and Faded. I get it right this time with Malia Christie. And always check out the Make It a Double podcast, which can be found on doublepodcast.podbean.com. We're trying to get some listeners there, because the more listeners he has there, the more listeners come over to me. And then vice versa. Check us out on Twitter at WWI Podcast. Also, you can email us, which I got a couple emails. All right, I'm on, I think, number 4. So thank you for the 4 people that have emailed me. It's waitwhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Also on Facebook, it's Facebook/WWI Podcast. Thanks for listening. We're very, very much appreciated. Look for us in a few weeks. We're going to be talking to Mr. Adams, and he's going to blow all our minds with, I'm sure, plenty of stuff. Paul, if you're listening, get your books ready, because we're coming for you. That's about it. Thanks.
Mother-in-laws, or, you know,
you more than one mother,
like people like that. People
setting up franchise.
Yeah. Like, I'm just saying, you know, just.